International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Well, hello everyone and welcome again to another edition of the program. It's very nice to have you with us. I'm Keith Parent. We begin today with an update of an update of an update on a story that we've been following for the past few months involving Tonga. A prominent publisher in Tonga says the government's decision to partially privatize the public broadcaster is the result of a personal vendetta. The public enterprise minister told Parliament last week that the Tonga Broadcasting Commission has not been able to pay its dividend and 49% of it will be sold off. The broadcaster and the prime minister of Tonga have been squabbling for months after he fired the broadcaster's chair and labeled the TBC an enemy of the government. The publisher, Kalafi Molola, told Don Wiseman he's not surprised at the government's move.
I think one of the things that this government has failed to see was that Tonga Broadcasting was never set up to be a commercialized operation. Of course, they've got to sell advertising and commercials just to be able for operations. They were always set up to be a public service, to provide a public service, not to provide so much profit to be able to pay government a dividend. So I think that's why they've got it wrong. And Tonga needs a broadcasting or a news service for the community. They don't need a business, commercialized business in terms of broadcasting. So I think the government, unfortunately, have got that wrong. From the very beginning, when the broadcasting network was set up, it was always for a community service. When there are disasters that happen in Tonga, the AM station covers all of Tonga, FM with better broadcasting locally. So it's really sad that they're going to do it this way. And obviously, if it's going to be privatized and sell shares on it, then somebody will purchase it and turn it into a commercial station. And there goes our community service for broadcasting.
What sort of interest do you think there'd be? I mean, obviously you're involved in broadcasting, you're involved in newspapers. Do you think there'd be any interest within the other media in buying this public service?
Of course, Tonga Broadcasting is very well equipped. And of course, we have to put a priority in terms of employment of those that are already employed by them. But we would be interested. As a private media, we would be interested. I think one scenario that is a possibility is that all other media groups can come together, maybe buy shares and become a part of Tonga Broadcasting. It is Tonga's biggest broadcasting, biggest media organization. They have the best equipment and they do have the best trained workers. So just to sell it to somebody because they have got the money, I don't think it's the best way to go. But we would be interested as a private media organization to be a part of buying it. And I think those of us in the private media may need to meet and talk together how we can do it.
How do you think the general public would react to it? Do you think it would bother them?
I think those that are in the know would be bothered by it so much. And one of the big questions is that does this mean that Tonga Broadcasting and their services, the quality of their services, the community services that they have provided, are we still going to have that? So that's going to be a big question. And let alone, of course, the fact that if they're going to sell it and downgrade it, there'll be the loss of employment for quite a lot of good journalists.
There's been this long squabble, hasn't there, going on between the government and the Tonga Broadcasting Commission. Is this what it's about? Because the government was dissatisfied with some of the things carried or not carried by the TBC and it's just decided to sell it off? Or can they in any way justify such a move?
Yeah, that's what it's all about. It's political. It's the fact that they cannot really control what's going on. It is a personal vendetta, and it's really a quarrel between the Prime Minister himself and what he thinks a government-owned media group should do. And it's very unfortunate, it's very sad, and it's going to affect the overall services that media provides for Tonga.
Well, as of the recording of this program, members of the G20 group are meeting in Germany. The Australian Prime Minister will seek to make cybersecurity the subject of some very frank discussions at the meeting. Malcolm Turnbull says social media and tech companies need to have better relationships with governments around the world to better combat terrorism. The ABC's James Vidor speaks next to Alistair McGibbon. He's a special advisor to the Prime Minister on cybersecurity.
Oh, well, I understand it's something the Prime Minister will talk about with his counterparts, obviously amongst a whole range of other things at G20. Mm. And just in terms of your introduction, I wouldn't want listeners to think that the government is talking about every communication that every normal citizen undertakes. I've spent my life dealing with the people that you don't want to be dealing with, whether they're criminals or others.
Yep.
And really, this is about our offline laws applying in the online space, our offline sensibilities and the concept of how society functions offline being applied online. And frankly, it doesn't need to sound as confrontational or as scary as it's often portrayed.
Is there an offline equivalent to government agencies getting a backdoor access to an encrypted messaging service? I mean, what's the equivalent?
Well, there you go. You've used the phrase backdoor. Backdoor implies that government wants to impose upon private providers online to have a weakness that the government can push open and gain access to communications.
How else would they do it?
Well, no one in government is suggesting a backdoor, and that's the important thing.
Well, would they do it?
Well, I've been in this space a long time, and what I'll say to you is you can try to have a pretty rational discussion, and it quite often ends up with things like a backdoor. So no one's talking about a backdoor. What the Prime Minister's talking about is cooperation from industry. Mm-hmm. And that is no different to the government expecting and the public expecting banks to cooperate if a criminal is using a bank service versus if you or I are using a bank service. It's exactly the same as the government expecting a bus company to cooperate if a criminal is using a bus service versus if a normal member of the public is using it.
Well, how do those tech companies cooperate in that way? I mean, if it's not a backdoor, if it's not a deliberate built-in vulnerability to an encrypted service, what's the other method of getting access to the information you want?
Well, it's important that there are two aspects of cooperation to talk about. The first one the Prime Minister talks about is those companies that provide services that are used to amplify people's voice. So if you're an extremist and you get online and you start trying to encourage others to commit violence, that's not acceptable offline and it's not acceptable online either. And there's a general acceptance, I think, in the community and certainly by the tech companies that I've dealt with over the last 15 years or so in my various roles, both working for those tech companies and as a police officer now in my current role, is that those companies have a responsibility to not have their services used as a soapbox by those who'll do us harm. And that's an expectation that that the public, I think
that's
has.
A reasonable community expectation, absolutely.
It is. And yet most would agree that those companies for a long time held a line that said, it's not our responsibility. We are just owning a venue. We set that venue up and people will use that venue as they see fit. So there has been a shift in that. And I think it's widely acknowledged that the companies are now starting to do the right thing. When it comes to encrypted communications, those people who manufacture the device or who manufacture the software will have a greater idea about how to gain access to information from that software or from that hardware than you or I might have, because they're the ones that manufacture it. Let me use an offline example. Mm-hmm. If you were the person that created and marketed provided a particular safe to the public. I will have great difficulty getting to that safe, but the manufacturer might be able to say, look, we don't telegraph this, and you don't need to know, police officer, how to get in there, but I can help you get into the safe, or I might be able to help you get in there. And this is about cooperation. It's about working with industry on how they can help ensure that their services are not used by organised crime, by terrorists, by other people that the rest of us despise. And that's all the discussion is. It's about saying, why can't we apply the same offline sensibilities of, mm-hmm. of society and the rule of law online just as we do offline? Because frankly, much of our online life manifests itself in the offline world these days.
To take that safe analogy, I mean, isn't online encrypted communication a bit like a safe company that makes safes that in the hands of the operator produce a code for opening which is inaccessible to the operator? It is random, it is chaotic, it is scrambled. Only you who have typed that in are aware of it, and there's no way of the operator divulging and finding out what that code is. Isn't that how encryption works?
Well, sure. Just like that safe manufacturer doesn't intentionally have faults in it, they might know where certain vulnerabilities are that in their next model they're going to fix. And let's talk about software here. Let's talk about the fact that my phone is updated on a regular basis by the hardware manufacturer, because what they do is they discover that there are things on that phone that need to be patched or updated. It's the same with my laptop. It needs to constantly have new code pushed to it by the people that created that code. That means that the company knows that there are vulnerabilities or things that aren't functioning properly that need to be updated. Why can't government go to those companies and say, look, we're not asking you to do anything special. We're not asking you to hardwire in a vulnerability, a backdoor. No one in government is suggesting that. And that's why I took issue with you using the word, because no one in government is saying it. But if you know that there's a way you could help us, and this phone was in the hands of a terrorist who we're now in lawful possession of that device, could you help us, please, as the US tried to do with the San Bernardino terrorist after his shooting of a whole heap of innocent people in his former workplace? How do we have that rule of law and that sense of cooperation come from companies? Because they don't want their services used by criminals. They want their companies used by the hundreds of millions of really good people out there. And no Western government, no government like the Australian government, wants to go and harm individuals in any way. They want to go after people that are going to do us harm, but whether they're organised criminals or terrorists.
The assumption in what you're saying, Alistair McGibbon, is that there are vulnerabilities in these systems. That is inevitable, and that the people who make these systems are aware of those vulnerabilities. But what if that's not the case?
Well, what I am saying is, why couldn't we expect best efforts on the part of those companies to help when this is a matter of life and death and the protection of individuals? We should stop this type of discussion where it's either we're all going to have complete and absolute privacy and protection versus the protection of the greater good of society. So they're always, you know, a police officer balances that every day, balances the rights of an individual versus the rights of society to be protected against sometimes that same individual.
Well, and we expect our governments to maintain a balance too on our behalf between security services and agencies which would like access to everything now, please.
This is the thing again. This implies that there's a back door. Now,
that would be the desire of the security agency to have access to as much information as it could. The thing that stands against that is government, which has an equal responsibility to protect the privacy of its citizens.
Well, it needs to protect its citizens full stop. And sometimes that does mean infringing privacy. As a police officer, I did that on a regular basis. I deal with those same agencies you're just talking about. None of them that I deal with, and I deal with them very regularly in this role, are after wholesale access to information. What they're after is the ability to go after information when it's necessary for the execution of their duties, which is to protect the Australian people. And that's what all these agencies are trying to do. Now, that doesn't mean they don't misstep from time to time. That doesn't mean that you don't need oversight, because Australian agencies have that oversight. We have a parliament, we have court systems, we have ombudsmen that look over all these things. So the simple fact is, we're not talking about some wild west here. These are agencies that are heavily regulated, are heavily obligated in the work that they do. But what we are saying is that as technology increasingly becomes pervasive, why is it so hard to have a discussion that says that the rule of law, the concept of civil society, should apply online as it does offline, that it should apply to these nice shiny tech tools that we all use just as it does to the non-shiny tools that we have, whether it's our house. I mean, there's nothing more infringing to an individual than having a search warrant executed upon their house or have their telephone calls intercepted. And yet we accept the fact that law enforcement from time to time, in a very rare number of cases, as a percentage of the population, will have those things done in order to protect society.
Well, we now accept the fact that you know the location of every phone call that I make on my mobile device.
No, no. You see, again, that's a fundamental conflation.
Isn't that
of,
the metadata?
Of the facts. No, you see, the retention of metadata by a telco, by my telecommunications provider, is not the same as that being in the hands of law enforcement or intelligence agencies. They still need to request that data, and they don't do it en masse. They do it because I want to know about Alistair McGibbon. You're the telecommunications provider for him. Please provide those records.
And when the nasties hack into those records and gain access...
Well, again, that's another great discussion to have because I can tell you, I know telcos well too, and they hold a huge amount of data that is of interest to criminals. And the stuff that criminals are interested in is not necessarily my metadata. Mm. They're interested in my credit card details. They're interested in my personal information.
Maybe even all your Medicare those things, number.
Well, we could talk about Medicare too if you like. But the point is this, that data is held by the telcos anyway. The metadata information, essentially the who did I call and who called me, that isn't of worth to criminals. It's of worth to law enforcement agencies who are trying to protect the public. And they do that on a case-by-case basis, looking for that information to assess to assist them sometimes, by the way, to exclude people from investigations as much as it is to include them in investigations. It is the least privacy-infringing thing you can do as a police officer compared to, for example, arresting you and questioning you or executing a search warrant on your house or intercepting your communications. So metadata, just because it's retained by telcos, doesn't mean it's accessed en masse by agencies. And again, it's, I think, illustrative of the fact that this is a really tough discussion to have and to keep it rational and to make sure that what we do is we talk about this as a society and say, look, and I prefer to talk about criminals than terrorists because the reality is criminals are the ones who are most likely to impact the average person on the street.
And most terrorists that we see who commit stuff are known to authorities, so which raises the question of exactly what information we're trying to get to discover what precisely when we're already aware of the activities of the people who commit the bad acts.
Well, you see, the you know, in a rule of law country like Australia, knowing about a person is different to being able to prove what they're about to do. And, you know, whether it's beyond reasonable doubt or beyond a level of suspicion required before you can do certain things as an agency. And so, again, I think it actually highlights positively that agencies are not looking at trampling everyone's rights. What agencies are saying, what the government's saying here, is that to gain lawful access to information is how you conduct investigations to protect the public. They're not always going to be done perfectly, by the way. We all know that. But this is not about wholesale surveillance, and it's not about wholesale access to every Australian's records. It's saying, for example, if I committed a crime today and the police seized my mobile phone that's sitting in front of me here during this interview, that they should rightly expect that the software companies and the hardware companies associated with that mobile device will assist where possible, where lawfully possible, to help solve a serious crime. And again, that's not dissimilar to expecting the bank to help or the telecommunications company to help or anyone else to help, because no one wants serious organised criminals to go about their business. They are the ones that are infringing our rights as normal citizens, as are terrorists.
And yet we also want to be able to live in a culture which respects our privacy, which respects the sanctity of the individual.
Absolutely. And that is the delicate balance that that a police officer or someone who works for a domestic intelligence agency has to actually do every day. There are laws and oversight that help keep that in check. There are parliaments that keep it in check. The reality is that a society, a free society, only comes about with a rule of law. And unless that rule of law applies equally to our old institutions as it does to our new institutions and these new pieces of technology, then we're allowing ourselves to actually have the concept of our civil society eroded. And that does no one any benefit. Having absolute privacy while I transact in an anarchic state is actually more harmful than, in a break glass provision type of way, i.e. on a case-by-case basis, that privacy may be impacted by government, but it's done as part of a much broader investigation, then that helps preserve society. This is not, this shouldn't be seen as a binary thing that we either have a surveillance state or a state of pure privacy, because offline, and you talked about us being a free country, we are, but there are rules, and there are times when agencies will infringe upon your privacy. That we've accepted that forever in the offline space. And what's interesting to me as someone that spent a long time in the online law enforcement space is there is some philosophical difference that these tech companies have applied over the years that has permeated in society to say we're above the law, we're beyond the law. And the reality is our society only exists because that bright light of law is shone, as the Prime Minister said the other day, in the online space as much as it is offline.
Alistair McKibben, there is one ironclad law of radio that we can't break, and that's the law of time. I'm afraid it's against us. Thank you so much for, well, a fascinating discussion.
The topic of cybersecurity, which will probably be on the agenda if Malcolm Turnbull, the Prime Minister of Australia, has his way. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now time for this.
Hi, my name's Colin Newell, and I'm the editor and creator of DXR.ca. Since the mid-90s, DXR.ca has been the go-to website for timely resources for the DXR, SWL, and broadcast listener. If you're looking for unbiased reviews of the most modern receivers and antennas, or are interested in participating in some of the more lively online forums all about radio, then come on by. DXR.ca, a world band radio website.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Charlie 105, it is PDF to journal.
Speed 220, Charlie 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
All right, now let's turn our attention to propagation, what's been happening, and what we can expect over the next 7 days. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith from Space Weather Services Australia. The global HF propagation forecast through July 8th. Normal at low and middle latitude bands, normal to fair at high latitudes. From the Space Environment Prediction Center, China, planetary A and X peaking at 13 on July 8th and 22 on July 13th. Solar flux peaking at 76 on July 10th and 18th to 20th. From Space Weather South Africa through July 8th, magnetic conditions quiet, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through July 9th, solar activity very low, geomagnetic field quiet. From FK Yanda in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to unsettled July 7th, 10th, 11th, 15th, 25th and 26th. Quiet to active on July 8th, 9th, 14th, 21st to 23rd. Mostly quiet on July 12th, 16th, 18th to 20th and 24th. Active to disturbed on July 13th. And quiet on July 17th. From SWPC in Boulder, G1 geomagnetic storm conditions likely on July 13th, with ANK indices of 23 and 5. Lowest ANKs of 5 and 2 on July 7th to 12th and 16th to 20th and 23rd to 29th. Solar flux barely peaking at 72, July 16th to 19th. William Hepburn's Tropo Index maps show extreme tropospheric ducting off southern Alta California and Baja California Norte peaking July 10th, along the coast of Mauritania all week. A across the western, central, and especially eastern Mediterranean, increasingly through at least July 11th. Along the coast of Angola, July 7th to 11th. Across the Red Sea and Persian Gulf all week. Between South Korea and China, July 9th.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. You can also listen to this program again, as well as download past editions, by visiting our website, pcjmedia.com. The website, of course, does look different now. On the, if I could remember correctly, it's on the right, top right. You'll see a thing called Programs, the word Programs. The menu comes down, choose Media Network Plus, and then you can subscribe to it in iTunes. It'll bring you to a program bank as well. Anyway, on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. Saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies.